If you had 25 athletes in your spreadsheet and then you calculated the mean or sprint time or jump height, whatever it is, right? A pretty, or even peak force in a mid-thigh pull. These tend to be pretty global outcome measures based, reliable and consistent data. Let's say the mean jump height was 40 centimeters. If you then calculated the standard deviation for that group, you'd probably find that the standard deviation for jump height ranged from anywhere between 5 and 25% of the mean, the group mean. When you do that task for asymmetry, it's not uncommon for the standard deviation to be 100% of the mean, which means that in English, that basically means you've just got loads and loads of within group variation in the asymmetry scores. And that's what I was talking about, how your data points don't get clustered together because they're all over the place. The range is so big. And that's where that inherent noise comes from.
Hi, Chris. It's my pleasure to have you in Evidence Strong Show. If you could briefly introduce yourself.
Sure, Alex. Thanks ever so much for having me. I'm very, very grateful to be invited and it's good to be able to come and have a chat with you today. My name is Dr. Chris Bishop. I am the current head of department for the London Sports Institute, Middlesex University, London, the UK. On top of that, I am an associate professor of strength and conditioning, and I currently run the master's program in strength and conditioning at the university as well.
Today, we're talking all things asymmetry. We have to start with the definition, interlimb asymmetry, what it is and how, what do we do with it?
Sure. Okay, so the key to start off, the key for the definition is the term interlimb. Okay, so interlimb means we are comparing one limb against the other limb. Okay, and an asymmetry just refers to whether or not we have a difference in function or performance between my limbs. Okay, it can be defined a number of different ways. So we could just look at the difference in function or performance between my left leg and my right leg. We might choose to define my limbs not as left and right, but as dominant versus non-dominant. Okay, because remember, we can't always guarantee that the dominant limb will always be the right limb or vice versa. So how you define the limbs has a bit of an impact on subsequent asymmetry calculations and outcomes. Other ways to define it might simply be to use the test score as the objective measure rather than the limb. So instead of having a comparison between left versus right or dominant versus non-dominant, you could just make a comparison between the highest value and the lowest value in the test scores. That's another way to define the difference. Or of course, if you start gravitating over to injury rehabilitation perspectives, you could just have involved versus non-involved, which is the terms I think they quite often use. I actually don't like those terms. I think they're actually harder to understand than most people realize. I think you could just say injured versus non-injured, right? But they essentially mean the same thing. So lots of different ways to compare a test score on one leg or one limb, sorry, relative to the other. And that's what interlimb means. We're comparing one limb's score or function relative to the other. And it's not to be confused with intralimb asymmetry, which is comparing test scores within the same limb. So a good example, I'll just give you a practical example for both of those. Hopefully that then gets the listeners, anyone who's not fallen asleep yet, understanding the difference between inter and intra. So intra limb asymmetry, they're often referred to as ratios rather than asymmetries, but that would be comparing something like peak torque of your hamstring versus your quadriceps, but only in the right limb, or comparing the strength of your internal versus your external shoulder rotators on the same arm. Whereas an interlimb would be something like, I want to compare, and the example could be anything, by the way, but if I jumped 20 centimeters on my right leg vertically, I jumped 18 centimeters on my left leg vertically, I've got scores of 20 and 18. The asymmetry, which is usually reported as just a simple percentage difference between the two scores, would be typically 20 minus 18, which gives you a difference of 2, divided by 20, the bigger score, multiplied by 100, and that gives you a 10% 100% asymmetry in that example. Okay, so I haven't done much, little bit. I haven't done much on intra-limb differences. Pretty much, I would say, probably close to 98, 99% of my research is on inter-limb, looking at differences in performance or function between one limb relative to the other. We've looked at that type of research, that type of study design, that type of question when defining our limbs differently, such as dominant versus non-dominant, or left versus right, or healthy versus injured, etc., etc. So we've got quite a lot of evidence from our research supporting a number of different ways that have various different strengths and weaknesses to them, I suppose. And then how we use it is probably the simplest thing to say, is that any time you can get a separate left leg score and a separate right leg score, you have the capacity to calculate subsequent asymmetry value. Whether you need to or whether you want to is a different discussion, but we can do that in essentially any task where you have separate left limb or right limb data scores.
Okay, so we know what it is and what options we have, at least roughly, but I think it's important to understand, why do we even consider asymmetries? Are they important? Are they not important?
Yeah, I think that's probably inherently the key question, right? I think there's two scenarios to elaborate on here, right? Which is athletic performance and injury risk mitigation, for lack of a better term. I'll start with the performance side of things. So the first thing in the athletic performance kind of narrative on asymmetry, the evidence base is pretty weak, okay, collectively, to say that asymmetry has a negative effect on independent measures of athletic performance or physical performance, right? I think generally speaking, and I think there's a few different reasons for that, right? Number one, asymmetry is a ratio. So I do quite a bit of work on this, and I've just had a kind of like invited commentary paper just accepted in the Journal of Strength and Conditioning Research about how we use ratio data in strength and conditioning. And a ratio, for anyone who's not sure, is a value that is made up of more than one component part. And asymmetry is a great example of that, right? We report asymmetry as a percentage. The metric of asymmetry is 4%, 6%, 10%, 12%, whatever the number is. But it's, in order to get a percentage value, you have to have separate left leg and right leg, or left limb or right limb test scores. So we basically have two data sources. Then we do a calculation and we turn it into one, right? And that's what any ratio does. You could say the same for RSI. You could say the same for DSI. And that causes quite a lot of problems, because ratio data, not all of them, but most of them, are noisy. They have much larger measurement error than the raw data that makes it up in the first place. So when you try and establish, either from an associative standpoint, which would be running correlations, or from a cause and effect standpoint from interventions, you run into lots of problems, because asymmetry is a ratio value, right? It's noisy. That means that the measurement error on it's very, very high. And let me explain very simply from both standpoints why that's a problem. If I were to try and run a correlation between, let's say, jump height asymmetry — the example doesn't matter, by the way — jump height asymmetry, a column of asymmetry data, and an independent athletic performance measure like 30 meter sprint time, for example. One of those test measures, sprinting, how fast you run, is pretty stable and consistent. So lots of people will have various different times, because people will run at different velocities. But assuming that they are trying hard, the consistency of their data from trial to trial is pretty good. And that means that the measurement error on data like velocity or time is pretty small. So it's a consistent, repeatable, reliable outcome for sprinting. Now take the other column of data, asymmetry, which is super noisy. When you try and plot that on a scatter plot and then plug in like a trend line or a regression line, you've got asymmetry on this axis, sprint time on this axis, and we'll plot asymmetry and sprint coordinates. And what you get is, because one of your metrics is super noisy, you get this on your scatter plot. Boom, 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 boom. They're all over the place. And when your data is not clustered together, you stand no chance of seeing like a slope to the regression line or to the trend line. What you get is just a flat line. And that means you start getting relationships or R values or Spearman P values, because asymmetry is not usually normally distributed data, that vary very rarely go above moderate. We're talking, you know, a relationship or correlation values that very rarely get above 0.3. And it doesn't seem to matter what the sport is. It doesn't seem to matter how big your sample is either. It's just that you have one metric that's really noisy, one metric that's really stable. It becomes hard to cluster your coordinates that you're plotting for those two axes really, really close together. Because someone might have really, really similar sprint times, right? And if you were only plotting sprint times, they'd be two data points put really close together. But someone who has a sprint time very similar to another person, but their asymmetry is wildly different, immediately moves them over here, right? And so all of a sudden you've got data points spread everywhere because one of your metrics is really, really noisy. Now, there was a guy called Kai Fox from Northumbria University, who I have to say did a much better meta-analysis than my systematic review. I did mine about 9 years ago and I have learned lots more since then. But he's kind of done a meta-analysis looking at the association between interlim asymmetry and how fast you run in sprinting, change of direction speed tests, and with strength tasks. And generally, there is a significant association, which basically means the larger my asymmetry, the slower I run. But that significant association only exists because there's just a lot of studies that have done research designs like that. And when you pool the data together because of the magnitude of studies that have done that, you get basically a very small effect. It is significant, but it's only significant because of the number of studies that have been done. And to reiterate that point, if I had 20 athletes and I look at the relationship between, I don't know, single joint peak torque on a biodex and how high I jump, I might get a relationship of something like, I don't know, it's just single joint quadricep torque, 0.4, I'm guessing now, really, right? With 20 athletes, the relationship would be 0.4 and it wouldn't be significant. But if I added another 100 athletes, I'm not sure that the R value, in fact, the R value might shrink a little bit, actually. It might go down to something like 0.35, 0.3 with a bigger sample. But it'd probably be significant now because my sample's 140 or 120 instead of 20. Now, it's only significant because of the number of people in there. But equally, an R value of 0.3, I don't care if it's significant. If it's 0.3, it's 0.3. It's not very strong. It's not telling us much, to be honest with you. It's only meaningful because of the number of people that you've recruited into the study design. And that's kind of a similar thing that's showing that asymmetry is associated with being slower at sprinting and change of direction speed tasks. But when you start looking at each individual study, and when you understand that you've got one of your metrics that you're trying to correlate against each other is really stable, the other one's really, really noisy, it's hard to see how you get any consistent and repeatable data. And that's another thing to talk about from a performance standpoint. I think we were actually the first to do it in my thesis from a healthy athlete perspective. What I found in my systematic review when we were trying to look at the relationship between athletic performance and asymmetry is that essentially most people had only done it for one single time point, you know? And if you've got a stable metric being compared to a really noisy metric, and then you go, oh, I've got an R value of 0.6, they must be slower. But actually, how do you know that that relationship is repeatable if you tested them again the next week or a month later? And the answer is, why does that matter? That matters because we know that one of the metrics is really, really noisy. And if it's really, really noisy, we've got no confidence that you'd get the same data if you tested them again. So we did that in my thesis and looked at a kind of repeated measures design over the course of a season. And actually, we found that relationships do not repeat themselves. Whatever relationship you got, next time you test it, you got a completely different value looking at the relationship between an asymmetry measure and an independent athletic performance measure. So actually, there are studies that have shown larger than moderate relationships, but I don't hold much value in them if they haven't been done on some sort of test retest design, right? Because we've got no confidence in knowing whether or not you'd get the same results again. And just to reiterate what I've said 100 times already, the reason why that matters is because it's a very, very noisy ratio metric. And just to illustrate for people so they can potentially even go and look at their own data sets, I think this is an important point to get across. If you had 25 athletes in your spreadsheet and then you calculated the mean or
sprint time or jump height, whatever it is, right? A pretty, or even peak force in a mid-thigh pull. These tend to be pretty global outcome measures based, reliable and consistent data. Let's say the mean jump height was 40 centimeters. If you then calculated the standard deviation for that group, you'd probably find that the standard deviation for jump height ranged from anywhere between 5 and 25% of the mean, the group mean. When you do that task for asymmetry, it's not uncommon for the standard deviation to be 100% of the mean, which means that in English, that basically means you've just got loads and loads of within group variation in the asymmetry scores. And that's what I was talking about, how your data points don't get clustered together because they're all over the place. The range is so big. And that's where that inherent noise comes from. The other point I was going to add, which we haven't touched on yet, when we deal in percentages, we're taking two sources of data and just using it as one. But what we lose is the directionality component, right? That's an important part of understanding asymmetry because, you know, we get no appreciation for like limb dominance characteristics. And that is perhaps not that important for an athlete who is recovering from an ACL injury because the imbalance is just there for a really clearly obvious reason. They've just had one limb totally incapacitated and they've had, whereas when they're coming back from injury and they're, approaching return to play and hopefully we've got some good restored function in that injured limb, however we're measuring it, it's not impossible for test scores to flip-flop. And so if someone has a 10% imbalance, and then the next time you measure it, it's 6%. I think most people would look at that and go, oh, intuitively, we're heading in the right direction. But actually, if it's 10% imbalance and the left leg scores higher, and then it's 6% imbalance, but the next time you test the right leg scores higher, you've not really had a 4% reduction. You've had a 16% shift. And actually, you now need to know why you've had that 16% shift as well, right? Is it because the left leg that was scoring better before but created a 10% imbalance is now scoring a lot worse and the other leg's come up a little bit? You might have had a shift, but actually one leg having much less capacity last time they tested, that's not a good thing either. You know, there's complexities around how we use this ratio data, and the intervention based research is not particularly thorough either. We did a meta-analysis on it and published it and basically found that, you know, you get a small reduction in asymmetry from doing strength and conditioning training. And actually, you don't need loads and loads of volume to get that reduction in asymmetry. But two things being, no one's really looked at, if I reduce an asymmetry in one task, what actually happens to performance, you know, within the sport or other subsequent surrogate measures. They've just gone, here's my asymmetry pre, here's the test scores post, and therefore here's my asymmetry post. But that doesn't really matter that much, to be honest with you. You know, what we want to know is, if you reduce an asymmetry, do you perform athletic tasks any better? No one's really properly looked at that. There was a study done in youth tennis, actually, by an author called Susanna Candro in 2014. They did look at that and they did a really, really nice reduction in asymmetry after training twice a week for 6 weeks in like 12-year-old tennis players, but they didn't actually run any faster once you start looking at the test scores, right? So I think, again, some of the changes after training interventions are also impacted by the standard deviation and the noise, right? You know, if I have this massive, massive variation in my test scores as a group for something like asymmetry, I can try and run a training intervention to try and change that. But because the standard deviation, the variation within the group is so, so big, it kind of precludes me from finding any meaningful change at the group level. So the solution to that is, if you think asymmetry is really important, you have to monitor it at the individual level, which is what we've been banging on about for years, right? And we also think that asymmetry should be subject to the same protocols as any test measure. And what that means is, if you're trying to establish a change in asymmetry, you should try and establish whether a change in asymmetry is greater than the measurement error, all right? To be able to establish whether or not that change is real or whether it's inside the error of the test. So the other thing I promised I'd speak to you about was whether or not there was any kind of glaring or obvious differences between different sports that are inherently one-sided. We've done a bit of research, well, we've done lots of research in team sport athletes on asymmetry, and we've done a little bit in tennis
okay, that I was part of a research group in Belgium. A guy called Laurent Chappelle was doing his PhD on asymmetry in tennis. And I think we did find some interesting stuff that was a bit different, actually, to some of the team sport data. The first thing to say with the team sport data, we were typically only testing during the lower body, and we were utilizing field-friendly test measures. Okay, so various different jump protocols. We were taking force plates into the field. We were measuring various different single-leg jumps, like single-leg drop jump, single-leg counter movement jump, and accruing lots of different metrics and data from the force plates. For tennis, we took a bit more of a holistic test battery. You know, we were doing lower body and upper body testing. We found that the lower body testing in tennis was just as variable and noisy as the lower body testing in all the other team sports that we've done. So I'm pretty convinced it's just that when you start doing single leg jumping in anyone, there's just lots of different strategies that that person can use to achieve a given outcome, right? And we know there's lots of information around, you know, changing your strategy in jumping to achieve the same jump height, depending on how you feel. But we did find that the asymmetries were way more consistent for the upper body. And I suspect that's, you know, partly because tennis is just so one side dominant, right? When you swing the racket, even if you swing the backhand with two hands, I think most of your force and velocity and power of movement comes from the, you know, the arm that you predominantly hold the racket with and that you swing when you swing forehand. If I jumped higher or produced more force on my right limb than my left limb at time point one, do I still do that when I retest at time point two, or has, you know, my limb dominance fluctuated and flip-flopped? And in the lower body, it flip-flops all the time. It's really rare for you to get good levels of agreement for lower body directionality of asymmetry. However, for the upper body, we were getting nearly perfect levels of agreement. And I haven't really done enough research to know whether or not that is a byproduct of them being a tennis athlete and therefore, you know, so one side dominant, or if it's a product of the upper body actually just generally being more consistent and stable in asymmetries than the lower body. You know, some of that will be related to the test measure. It might just be a bit of both. But I haven't really done enough upper body asymmetry testing in other sports to be able to definitely have the answer to that. But I think it's maybe probably a little bit of both, in all honesty. Is that, you know, in tennis, you know, everyone's probably back in the day seen the size of Rafa Nadal's left arm relative to his right arm. You know, it was like three times the size at one point, I think. So naturally, he's going to have quite a large, you know, interlimb difference in strength and power between his left arm and his right arm. And I think that's fine. That's the functional byproduct of playing tennis, probably. And that's probably the other thing that practitioners always need to ask themselves, right? Is that once you have an asymmetry, because you asked me earlier, you know, should we care? Once you have an asymmetry that is, I'm going to say this next bit with a bit of caution, you know, like sizable or notable. And the obvious answer to that is, oh, what does that mean? Is it 10%? Is it this? Is it that? That really have an exact answer for you, truth be told. But I think if the asymmetry is greater than the measurement error of each limb, firstly, that's important, because then if it is, we know that the asymmetry is real and it's not, you know, inside the error of the test.
Do you consider it one standard deviation or two standard deviations?
We typically utilize so we do this for an individual person rather than a group, right? So we will, let's say that you, let's say we're measuring peak force asymmetry in a bilateral counter movement jump. We've got our separate force values for left and right legs. We do three trials and we get peak force values for each trial. I can then calculate the coefficient of variation, right, for peak force across those three trials. And let's say that across those three trials, I have an average asymmetry of 5.6%, and the coefficient of variation for peak force, so the measurement error for that metric that I'm reporting asymmetry for, is 4.1%. I have a asymmetry that's greater than the measurement error, so I know it's real. Whereas if my coefficient of variation, which was larger than my asymmetry, the asymmetry is less than the noise or the variance in the test, and therefore it's not real. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Yeah, so that's how we would, and we would do that for each individual, because each individual can have their own coefficient of variation calculated. And that's an important concept, right? Because, well, firstly, coefficient of variation is a percentage, right? So you're comparing percentage to percentage. And although it's anecdotal, that seems like a fair comparison to make. I'd probably only be worried about asymmetries that are real, so greater than the measurement error, consistently as well, over more than one test session, you know, two or three test sessions, and that show, so it's quite a specific criteria now I think about it, but also show consistent limb dominance characteristics. I'm not worried about, on my right leg, I had a 10% asymmetry and my left leg scored better. Next session, it was 4%, but my other limb scored better. You know, data that does this is natural fluctuations in what we call performance variability. But data that is does this, and the next time you test does this, and next time you test does that, and then that, and then that, and that, you've got the same limb consistently underperforming relative to the other. I'm not convinced that the percentage difference is the problem, but I am convinced that if one limb is consistently weaker than the other, maybe you have a capacity issue. And I don't think there's anything bad that can come from trying to give a limb more capacity, because all you do by giving it more capacity is you improve its tolerance to handle stress, load, and strain. And that's probably a good thing for mitigating injury risk. That's probably a nice transition to just briefly touch on the injury side of things now.
So great, and I'm in my head like, no, not
but I think the narrative around asymmetry and injury is a bit different. Actually, you know, I think typically medical professionals are dealing with athletes or patients who have an imbalance which is there for a reason, you know, particularly for a serious injury like an ACL or like an Achilles rupture or something like that. Because you're incapacitated for such a period of time, you of course immediately lose muscle cross-sectional area, muscle mass, you immediately lose function, and therefore you immediately lose or reduce your performance in a given task or a given test. I think part of getting someone healthier is restoring that function back to, if you're measuring it, baseline levels, but there's also probably a discussion to be had about whether baseline levels were good enough in the first place, depending on the mechanism or how the injury happened. But generally speaking, you know, it's undeniable that a medical professional's role for someone who is injured is to reduce pain, restore function, restore range of motion. And restoring capacity will inherently, in one injured limb, naturally start to close the gap, you know, in terms of function or performance test scores. I think asymmetry is relevant from an injury standpoint for some of the very brief and obvious reasons that we just touched on. From a performance standpoint, I think it's very nuanced situation where it might be relevant. We need to see an asymmetry being greater than the measurement error. We need to see it being greater than the measurement error consistently, more than once, so that we know that the data is not flip-flopping. And if we've consistently got this underperforming limb, I think we then need to ask ourselves, is that there? That asymmetry, is it there because of a functional adaptation to the sport? Maybe, but I think that's unlikely, truthfully, in team sport athletes. Is it there because we haven't, you know, restored function after a prior injury and we've still got residual deficits, possibly, in some athletes? Or is it there and I'm just not worried about it? If a limb is consistently underperforming relative to the other, you know, in whatever test or metric we're measuring, I don't think anything bad can happen from trying to give a consistently underperforming limb more function, more performance, okay, more capacity. There's probably nothing bad that can happen from doing that. So almost inadvertently striving for symmetry whilst concurrently trying to just get capacity improved in both limbs anyway is probably not a bad strategy, because like I said, all we do is we just improve a tissue's tolerance to handle stress, strain, and load.
Any advice for coaches? What they should, injuries? So the message about injury rehabilitation and bringing athletes back is, yes, of course, use it. Try to bring the capacity of the injured limb to at least the level of the healthy one. Although, as you mentioned, it may be not enough to protect the athlete going forward. With athletic performance, doesn't look that well. So what do you want to leave coaches with?
I think, yeah, so I'll just revisit one thing very quickly with the injuries. We want to make sure that, you know, we restore function in the injured limb, but we should also maybe be mindful that if an athlete's gone through a serious injury, we might get a drop off in test scores in the healthy limb too. And that's something that's really important to be mindful of and to monitor and keep in mind. From the athletic performance side of things, yeah, I probably wouldn't waste too much time investigating asymmetry, given what the body of evidence suggests. And, you know, a lot of that body of evidence has come from our research. So, you know, I'm trying to have a balanced scientific perspective on it than any biased perspective. My parting advice then is just rely more on the raw data. You know, we're always talking in training athletes about how the basics work and how like fads and gimmicks of training never stand the test of time, and how the basics of just good fundamental strength and power training always stand the test of time and last. I honestly think it's the same principle and the same message for testing and data analysis. You know, like just do your needs analysis, understand your individual athlete's training and injury history well, devise your, you know, probably like a squad testing battery with a few nuanced add-ons for some individual athletes depending on what their training and injury history is, and just rely on the raw data. The process of monitoring data over time should always be done in conjunction with the measurement error, whether it's asymmetry or raw data. Yeah, like we're talking about both just testing in general now.
Yeah.
And let that be your guide both at the group and at the individual level as to whether or not you've seen true or meaningful change.
It's sensible message. Okay, two last questions to finish. The first one is, what is your favorite lift?
My favorite lift?
Yeah.
Does it have to be an Olympic weightlifting lift?
No, it doesn't have to. Your favorite.
Okay, my favorite is probably the trap bar deadlift, just because I'm quite tall. And I always do that on a Monday morning for my total body lift in my routine. And just enables me to get into a safe position whilst putting some degree of tonnage through my legs.
It's that feel good lift.
Yeah, it is a feel good lift really, isn't it? But as I said earlier, I'm a bit of an old man now, so I'm going to prioritize what I like doing more than what's necessary. And I don't play sport anymore. I used to play football. I play a bit of golf. I'm not training to try and improve performance. I'm training because I like training and try and stay healthier, you know.
Fair enough. And where people can find you if they want to follow you or ask a question, see what you publish.
Ooh, yeah, okay. I'm on LinkedIn. I'm also on X, used to be Twitter, for @DrChrisBishop. So feel free to reach me on there. And if anyone wants to email me, they can do, which is just c.bishop@mdx.ac.uk.
Amazing. Thank you so much for today.
You're very welcome. Thanks for inviting me. It's been nice to meet you.